Welcome back to another episode of the Medical Narratives Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Gordon, a geriatrician from Toronto, and today we discuss the topic that is very close to many hearts, especially mine, geriatric care in Canada. Joining to help us today is a very special guest and dear friend and colleague, Dr. Barry Goldless, Professor of Geriatrics at the University of Toronto. Together, we will explore the current state and future trajectory of geriatric medicine. So without further ado, let's go to the topic of caring for our aging population. Welcome, Barry.
Thank you, Michael.
As a well-known figure in the specialty, and the two of us go back a long way from the almost inception in Canada, could you share your insights on the current state of geriatric care in Canada, and what are some of the notable advancements or challenges?
Well, let's start off with challenges, because there are more of those and it's easier to pick them out. I think one of the major things that geriatric medicine has done wrong is to pretend that we're not responsible for people in long-term care and assisted living. I think, yes, it's family physicians and family physicians with extra training in geriatric care, the major figures there, but we have a lot of power to push for improved care in those areas. It's not, and I think, Michael, you are the one who most forcefully in the past has spoken about that, long-term care does not represent a failure. Sometimes the right approach for a certain group of people. We want to always let people age at home and provide the supports there, but it's not always necessary. And COVID was a wake-up call for us that the huge number of deaths, particularly in Ontario, in long-term care was just devastating. Being an aging physician myself, I was at the beginning of COVID doing virtual consultations. But one of the things I did was virtual rounds in a long-term care facility with the attending physicians. Mostly it was one younger attending physician who saw all the patients and reported back to the older physicians who were similarly in my situation that before the vaccines were very vulnerable themselves. And it was just terrible to see. And one of the problems in that home, which was a nonprofit home, there was overcrowding. And, you know, one of the things that happened many years ago, we changed the requirements for space in long-term care, but we never demanded that older places had to be upgraded. And obviously for nonprofits, we never provided the ability for them to upgrade. So it was one of the worst experiences, I think, that people who are interested in geriatrics have ever experienced. But it was COVID brought it out, but it's a long-term problem. So I think we're starting, geriatricians have now been involved in standards for long-term care. So we're starting to regroup from that. And the Americans have always done it better because it was understood that specialists in geriatric medicine there, which do a lot of primary care, were always involved in long-term care. So they've had better advocates, I think, for a long time.
Barry, I want to just put in here one personal anecdote at the place I worked for many years. By chance, a spot came up in the home for the aged from one of the family doctors who had to leave. And as it turned out, one of the geriatricians, fully trained, certified geriatricians, said she would take over for a period of time until we found a replacement. And I remember her saying after a few minutes, she said, "This is very complicated medicine. I never realized just what a challenge it was." And this was somebody who, as in our model, our main role is to act as consultants to other physicians. And, you know, in a way, we're protected from the day-to-day challenges. And she made the point very clearly. So I agree, the model has to change in terms of what, even though there's a limited number of us, how we integrate and interface with the long-term care system. I agree completely.
I have a niece who's a geriatrician in Boston at one of the Harvard-affiliated hospitals. She's thinking of coming back to Canada, thank God. But she has, well as her other duties, she has patients in a long-term care facility. And she says, yes, it's complicated. They're difficult patients, but it's very fulfilling. And she really enjoys that part of her practice.
All right, let's go to another question. How do you see the landscape of geriatric care evolving in Canada over the next decade? Are there any emerging trends that you believe will significantly impact the field. And some of this may have been started in the last question.
I think one thing is, you know, from a doctor's point of view, are we recruiting enough people into geriatric medicine? Toronto, we've been very successful. We filled all our spots. We've sometimes gotten extra spots, and the quality of people has been breathtaking. But I'm not sure that that is replicated throughout the country. And there are lots of places where they don't fill their slots. And so that's always going to be a concern in the future for me, is do we have enough personnel? Do we have enough nurses who are interested in geriatrics and gerontology? Toronto has been doing well, but even then, the number we turn out each year is enough to keep Toronto satisfied, but barely scratching the surface for the rest of Ontario, let alone for Canada. The other thing from a clinical point of view is the understanding of how frailty impacts. I think geriatricians have been a little bit sheltered from this because when people are referred to us, they're almost automatically, we've considered them frail and we've taken that viewpoint. But frailty, and we have in Halifax, Kem Rockwood is one of the world's leaders in the understanding of frailty. And there, obviously, Canadians love the Rockwood frailty scale because it's easy to use. But we haven't operationalized frailty. In other words, we see thousands of articles showing that if you're frail, outcomes are worse. But we have to be able to operationalize it. In other words, we have to be able to say to a family doctor, if you've got an elderly patient with high blood pressure, but their frailty score is 5, don't treat them. The risks are greater than the benefits. If they're 2, yes, we know from the many studies that blood pressure in vigorous elderly people is beneficial to treat. And you know, if there's intermediate numbers, maybe that's the kind of person you refer to a geriatrician for the final judgment about whether the risk versus benefit profile is acceptable. But we've got a lot of work just for the simple things to operationalize frailty. And obviously, the first step in operationalizing it is to agree on which frailty scale to use, which is different everywhere in the world. And there's going to be, if you have a decent electronic medical record, you can refine further any frailty scale you want to use with simply obtained lab data, creatinine, hemoglobin, et cetera. A few things will refine even further the frailty scale. So we have the theoretical ability to do those studies to operationalize some of these common syndromes in older people, but we haven't really started on a lot of that yet.
Yeah, I want to ask you, Barry, I think we've all benefited greatly and enjoyed watching the development of the family practice arm of care of the elderly. And it started really in Toronto, and we've seen some marvelous, and I've worked with marvelous care of the elderly. And there doesn't seem to be a great impetus for physicians to take on that extra year, even though they enjoy it. And I've spoken to a number of them because I've worked with them. They say that they enjoy doing it and they know that it's worthwhile. But from the economic point of view, it doesn't make things much better for them. And I wonder, I think geriatricians finally, after many years of lobbying, managed to get remuneration that at least is not unreasonable compared to others. I mean, I hate to go around, this one makes that. But care of the elderly, you can't have somebody take on another year and then find, with all the extra work, they're no better off financially. So how do we address that part?
That obviously has to go through the Ontario Medical Association, and they've got to be convinced that that's an important thing to negotiate for. It's hard. You know, the original geriatric codes were not by geriatrician, but by a family doctor who was interested in geriatrics, a classmate of mine. And what happened was, when I was the president of the OMA section on geriatrics, I tried to get a special, you know, increase in remuneration for a consultation for geriatrics. It was blocked at the OMA, and the key blockers were the orthopedic surgeons, who said they did functional assessments just like geriatricians, and therefore geriatricians didn't need it. So my classmate, who then was one of the attending physicians at the old Queen Elizabeth Hospital, said, "Barry, you did it wrong. Never ask for an increase in money. Ask for a separate code. Then the OMA can analyze what it's going to cost them. And because there are so few geriatricians, it costs peanuts. And then you'll be able to get more money over the years." So he said, "I'm not going to let you do this through the tariff committee. I've had a lot more experience than you. And so he shepherded it through the tariff committee. We got no extra money that first year, but we've gradually gotten an increase that has made particularly outpatient geriatrics
yes.
a feasibility. It was completely unfeasible before we got the increase, because it just takes a long time, you know, and we always talk about residents becoming more efficient. 40 odd years in geriatrics, I'm still not efficient in seeing an elderly patient for the first time. There's just so much data that has to be accumulated. And in a way, it makes me happy. I like the thought that if somebody is going to interview me in the medical field, that after an hour, they're not going to know me. There's more to me than can be achieved in 1 hour of asking about past operations. So it's not so terrible for me, that, but it takes a long time. And then there's a lot to explain, either to the family or to the patient, depending on the circumstances. And so you just can't do it in a rapid time frame if you want to do it well.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, as you know, and some of the people who participate in the podcast know, I had to retire because of illness for a number of years. And I came back and started working at, which I do part-time, at a memory clinic. But all of my patients are, you might call, in the elderly, sometimes very elderly field. And I'm finding that it takes easily an hour and a half between the family and the explanations. And as you know, Barry, you know, by the time you finish, then the family member says, I have a few questions. And you basically take a deep breath and listen. And every question is meaningful. And you can't just say, well, look it up, even though some of them can. And I have found that putting in the effort and time pays off, because in terms of adherence and cooperation, they trust that you've taken the time. So I think that's really important. And whoever your colleague was who was on the impetus to raise fees, I commend, I probably know him, but I'm not going to mention him online. Anyway, here's another interesting question. One crucial aspect of ensuring the future of geriatric care in Canada is attracting young people into the field. What initiatives or strategies are being implemented to spark interest among medical students and young physicians in pursuing careers in geriatrics? And how can we continue to cultivate this interest to address the growing demand for specialized care for older adults? That's a very long question. I almost want to give the answer, provide them each with a wonderful grandparent, because that's what influenced me.
That would help. That's hard to accomplish.
Yes.
particularly in this mobile society where they might be far distant from where their grandparents are, even if they're fortunate enough to have grandparents. It's a difficult issue. I think there are obviously role models in every area crucial. So, and I think that one of the things that have been over the years, many geriatricians who also did general medicine. And so the residents, medical students could see that you can be a really good doctor and still be a geriatrician. We know, those in the field know, that you have to be a good doctor to do geriatric medicine, but it wasn't always apparent to students. So I think that that is an important thing, that the geriatricians that we have be seen to be really good physicians, really good internists, so that they can attract others to the field. We know in academic medicine, success in academics. So the current physician in chief at St. Michael's Hospital here in Toronto, Sharon Strauss, is a world famous researcher, particularly in the area of knowledge translation. And residents can see that they could become a famous scientist if they want to go into academic, like become a clinician scientist and make it as a geriatrician, because we've got great example there in Sharon Strauss. And also we have the physician in chief at Baycrest, who is a renowned clinician scientist, Gary Nagley, the vice president of research at Women's College, Paula Rochon, who's a geriatrician. So that is inspiring for people who want to go into geriatrics, you know, that they can hit the top of the field by going into geriatrics in academia or in the community. So I think that that is really important. We're going to be starting at U of T a compulsory clerkship, not this coming year, but the following year. So I think that that is helpful. But somehow, you know, ophthalmology, ENT, with very limited exposure in the undergraduate curriculum, have had no trouble getting residents. And that, you know, maybe we should be studying what they do. Part of it is a financial aspect.
Oh, yes.
But it's not just the financial aspect. One of the things that has really helped, we always talk about the dangers of the internet and being able to find things and being misled, but that's actually been a boon for geriatric medicine, because when the residents search, hey, they see that there's jobs available everywhere in geriatrics, whereas there might be a paucity in orthopedic surgery. So that is helpful. What is unhelpful had been in the past, I haven't looked at it recently, is that you also get estimates of OHIP billing, for example. And medical students don't always realize that often geriatrics is supported in other ways besides just OHIP billing. So they get a mistaken idea of what the income of a geriatrician might be. But still, I think in general, it's been a boon when residents can look and see that, hey, there are jobs available. And that means that they're going to speak to the geriatricians that they've had contact with and maybe be inspired more. So I think that that is an important aspect. But it, you know, you have to have the right people in place. And you wonder about the rest of the country when you hear that, I don't know the details, but when you hear that places have not been filled, is it a lack of mentorship? Is it, you know, we know for some medical schools in the past, they would not just assign places for geriatrics, endocrinology, whatever, you know, for internal medicine subspecialty. They would say, we're going to take the best people. And automatically, they assumed that anybody who applied to cardiology was better than geriatrics. And therefore, they took the cardiology trainee and gave the spot to them rather than to geriatrics. That has fortunately changed, I think, mostly by government action and pressure rather than by schools coming to their senses. But it still is better. But it gives you an idea of the prejudice that was faced by geriatric medicine for many years.
Idea of mentoring, I think, is right on. And it's funny, when I decided to go into geriatrics, it didn't exist in Canada as a certified specialty. And I went and got advice from a physician I met while I was overseas. And he suggested, and I said, gee, it doesn't exist. He says, yes, but, and he told me about Baycrest. But in my medical training, and I trained in Scotland, of the great physicians that helped train me, two out of them were the geriatricians. And what I liked about them is, one, they were wonderful, as you said, physicians, like really good physicians, but had a wonderful manner. And I love the way they, well, part of it is a culture in Scotland, the way they spoke to the patients. It was always warm and caring with lots of humor. And I find that people often ask me, what do you do with these old people? And I say, what do you do? That's where I get my stories to write books. They're full of stories and laughter. And just reminded me, I saw a patient yesterday who I'd seen before with quite marked cognitive impairment and Parkinson's, and, you know, was being evaluated for cognitive impairment. And he had been put on an antidepressant, which I had suggested because I thought that was actually part of the thing. And we were sitting there and he started laughing at what I considered not great jokes, but they're, you know, the kind of jokes that people of his generation and his background know. And I said to the son, he's laughing. Do you know how important that is? And he laughed again. And I said, that's a very good indication that he's responded to his treatment. The fact that he can't remember that it's last week or this week is not that important in terms of his life. After all, he's 98, he's living at home, and he's managing, but he's now laughing. So we have to understand what we're doing in this field. I mean, you don't have to cure everything to make life really important and more satisfying for people. So let's go on to this. In your experience, what are some of the key factors contributing to successful aging among older adults? How can healthcare providers and policymakers better support healthy aging initiatives? This is really important because I tell people, if you read the media, newspapers, whatever, every week there's 2, 3, 4 articles. They're online of what we should do. The 12 keys to healthy age, you know. So it's out there, but how do you get people to really adopt them?
So I think the interesting thing, you know, if you go back to the Framingham data from 1976 and compare it to 2016, elderly patients have about half the risk of developing dementia in 2016 as they had in 1976. So something good has happened. You know, it's always difficult to know what did that. You know, if you're a doctor, you say it's our management of high blood pressure and convincing people to stop smoking. If environmental activist, you'd say it's taking lead out of the gasoline, because that happened in the mid-1970s, and lead is a major neurotoxin. You know, the We don't know why, but it's a good trend. And the same results when you look at elderly people and inability to do certain activities of daily living, inability to do them has declined dramatically over the years as well. So an 80-year-old is much less likely to be demented and much more capable of doing activities of daily living currently than they did 50 years ago. So something has gone right. We're not sure what. I found that the simple result, a study of successful aging, are still the key. One of the things, and that was simply good nutrition and exercise are the foundations of good health. And the longer you do them, the more impact they have. And the mantra throughout the book was, the more exercise, the better. Anything is better than nothing. And the earlier you start, the better, but it's never too late. So I think, one of the studies that always affected me the most was the study about pregnant women during the Dutch famine in 1944, before Canadian troops, CA, liberated Holland or the Netherlands. We found that during the famine, I can't remember which trimester, I'm not an obstetrician, because some were worse than others, but if the mother was starving, the children of that pregnancy at age 50 were more likely to have heart attacks and other vascular disease. So what we know is that the process of disease, whether it's dementia, anything else, is not a something to be addressed in old age. It's life course development. The same way it was a geriatrician, Norman Exton Smith, who discovered that osteoporosis is a disease of young people that has its clinical manifestations in old age. In other words, that your peak bone mass in your 20s is what determines whether you're going to fracture your hip in your 80s. So we have to stop looking at old age as a different part of life. It's just a continuum of life. And so I think the biggest bang for our buck is going to be in convincing young people, that they have to start living healthy at a younger age. And unfortunately, society is not going that way. So there might be a tsunami of osteoporosis and diabetes that we think is starting now, but we ain't seen nothing yet. So somehow society has to turn around a bit. And the foundation of a healthy old age is a healthy young age. I really think that as much as I love geriatric medicine, when you think about that study in the Netherlands, we've got to make sure that women have healthy pregnancies and really support that, because that's going to lay the foundation of a healthy life as well. Looking at it as life course rather than as old age, that is a key thing to address, in my opinion.
Barry, I want to add to that because it's interesting, because I'm now dealing with this with every new patient I see. And it's part of my experience when I was working at Baycrest is the effect of hearing loss on cognition and how the relationship has been found to be more than, well, if you didn't hear it, you can't remember it. And the thing is, for many people, they discount hearing. And I'm very worried with the younger generation for which wearing high intensity hearing earphones is part of their life. I mean, I have a son who's a heavy metal guitarist, and it took a while for me to convince him to wear ear protectors when he's playing. And after he realized how important it was, he managed to get his whole band to invest in proper hearing protection. But I'm really worried that in the future, talk about epidemics. An epidemic of hearing impairment and its subsequent impact on cognition is something we have to worry about. So I have another question.
Let me just comment on that, Michael.
Okay, yes.
In my experience, it seems that loneliness and separation from society is greater with hearing loss than with
Yes.
visual loss. We always worry about blindness. That's difficult as well, but there are more workarounds for visual loss than there are for hearing loss. So
Yes.
it's really devastating when people can't hear. And
Yeah.
whether it's an association or a cause and effect relationship, we don't know, between cognitive function and hearing, they're clearly associated. And if whether they're cause and effect or not, one exacerbates the other dramatically. So
Yes,
it's a
absolutely.
huge problem.
Yeah. Now that I'm wearing hearing aids for various reasons, I appreciate it. And I actually lost some of my hearing many years ago because I was exposed to very loud noise when I would visit the hangars, the mechanics, when I was in the Air Force to make sure that the mechanics wore their hearing protectors. But because I was the doctor and so smart, I didn't. and I now have one of my ears. I'm sensory deficient, and we had to do a lot of manipulations of my hearing aids to restore at least some of the hearing. So here's another question. With the aging population in Canada, where there's a growing demand for geriatric services, we maybe should even change the term from geriatric services to elder care services, because it sounds a little less kind of focused. But the older, it says older, how can we ensure that these services are acceptable for all older adults, regardless of socioeconomic status or geographical location? And the latter I know because I'm seeing people who are referred to me from the northern parts of Ontario because there's nobody doing what we're doing in the various memory clinics in Toronto further north. And that's a long way to come, even though some of them perhaps can be done partially virtually these days.
That's a really difficult problem. It hasn't been solved for all aspects of healthcare, let alone for older. But we know that in a lot of smaller communities in remoter areas, that younger people have gone to the big cities, and therefore the actual proportion of older people can be greater than in southern Ontario, for example. I used to go up to northern Ontario when I was younger and had more energy to do consults a couple times a year, which I really enjoyed because you were treated so wonderfully. Yes. So I think this is an example. We're going to have to use more telemedicine, but telemedicine by itself is not enough.
No.
So you have to enable younger, say, family physicians and others, which we're also dramatically short of, to run memory clinics. We have them in southern Ontario. We need to expand them throughout the province, but who have links with either dementia specialists or geriatricians for difficult cases, and to, you know, do occasional roundups so that we can learn from each other. So I think we have better technology that can allow that, but it's costly to do it. Now, I used to go often to a small town called Fort Frances, and there was a fabulous family physician who was British and was going to go end up in Victoria, but somehow loved Northern Ontario and didn't get to Victoria until after he retired from medicine. And they had about 15 or 16 family doctors, and they organized themselves under Richard, this senior physician's guidance. Each person had an area of interest, and the group put the resources together. One of the family physicians would subscribe to a prominent cardiology journal and go once a year to a cardiology conference, et cetera, et cetera. So they could refer to each other because some people have more expertise in certain areas. And it worked extremely well. So you can do that, but it obviously, these things work if it's a local initiative from the ground up rather than somebody in the provincial ministry or from an academic teaching hospital say, this is how you have to do it. So people have to figure it out. But it seemed to me to work extraordinarily well that you had, and clearly expertise in geriatrics and dementia care is becoming more and more crucial. And as I said, many of these smaller towns have a higher proportion of older people than the provincial or national average because young people have left.
I think there are certain limits to virtual medicine. I've had some experience with it now, but if the place has organized so that the patient is in the process of being evaluated by a family physician who's interested, the issues that are of a concern can be communicated virtually in a way that helps the physician without, I mean, it is possible to have people come up on a rotational basis, but one, it's disruptive and it's expensive. But if somebody's taking, and we've seen this also with nurse practitioners, if somebody's taking the initiative, and psychiatrists as well, at the part with the patient, then the virtual assessment can be useful because we certainly have to do something. People shouldn't have to travel from Fort Frances to Toronto. Well, now there's somebody in Barrie, I just found out, you know, who can do this. That's a long way to go for an assessment. And the hardest part is after you've seen them and you want to do follow-up, you certainly don't want them to keep coming down in order to do the follow-up. Now, here's another very important question. What's the role of interdisciplinary teams providing comprehensive care for elders? How can collaboration between geriatricians, primary care physicians, nurses, and all other healthcare professionals be optimized to better meet the needs of older patients?
Really difficult question. It's been relatively easy, if you can get the resources, to build a team in a hospital setting. The key to teamwork is trusting each other. The key to trusting each other is knowing each other. In a hospital, you know, it's the same people over and over again, so we get to know each other. We know each other's limitations and strengths. That's much harder to do on an outpatient basis. You know, we're talking about the use of telehealth. You have to develop teamwork in that. It's got to be the same primary care providers that you work with, so you know each other, your strengths and weaknesses, and you can trust opinions. So I don't have a real answer to that. You know, for example, we have strong evidence from clinical trials that a heart failure pathway, and remember, heart failure is a geriatric disease predominantly, works for outpatient care of heart failure patients. But the studies were done with nurses who were specially trained, who had direct access to the cardiologists. We have a heart failure pathway in Toronto where you don't know who the hell is seeing them. They have no access to you. You have no access directly to them who are doing the follow-up. So you don't know how effective it is. I'm hoping it's effective, but a team hasn't been built that is working. And it's very difficult in a huge city like Toronto to develop that kind of teamwork on the outpatient basis. I'm going to have to, I really don't have an obvious answer. I know that that building of outpatient teams is important, but it isn't easy. You know, We have the house calls program at Sinai, and they built their own teams so that, you know, even if the person is not coming from the team, but from home care, it's the same person all the time. So they developed great teamwork in providing primary care to housebound older patients. But it's not an easy task.
Thank you. Here's a question that you actually alluded to, but this focuses on it. As we strive to improve the quality of life of older adults, how can we address issues such as social isolation and loneliness, which can have significant impacts on health and well-being? You mentioned the terrible, and I witnessed them among some family members, deterioration in people who are in long-term care and isolated. And if I'm not mistaken, in the UK, they've actually started either a ministry or a department looking specifically at loneliness. And I just wonder what kind of prescription we can come up with to help the government, because somebody has to do something. Families do have limits, even the very best of families.
Yeah, the world has changed from 100 years ago when you're expected to care, or 150 years ago, when there were no, you know, societal resources. Everybody was responsible for their grandparents or parents as they aged. That's no longer possible. Whenever, you know, the average family is overwhelmed already with everybody having to work, childcare being so expensive and difficult. So it just can't be done that way. Once again, you know, the association between loneliness and morbidity and mortality, we don't know if it's cause and effect. So they've been too glib in saying it, but it's a real problem. You know, human beings, the original study that I enjoyed the most was from the 1980s in Denmark, where they had housebound elderly people, and they randomized one group to usual care and the other group to getting a friendly volunteer to phone them and talk once a week, not somebody with medicine knowledge. And the likelihood of dying in the next year or being hospitalized next year was much less in those who had a friendly volunteer speak to them. So to me, that's 40 years ago that study was done. And I don't think anything that we've done has highlighted as easily. We don't know what it's a black box, right? Did the volunteers say, no, you're not feeling well, you better go see your doctor? We don't know. But I always interpret it as that human beings were not meant to be hermits, and yes, that social interaction is vital for health. How we accomplish that, agencies like Sprint in Toronto have made a living of organizing regular luncheon meetings for older people, making sure they have transportation so they can meet with other people. We have to make it possible for people who don't drive and who don't have family nearby to help them to participate in these things. Once again, it's not an easy thing to do. It does cost money. But if that study from Denmark from so many years ago is correct, it might decrease hospitalizations for all we know. So I think, and just sort of have an obligation that everybody in society should be able to enjoy life. That's sort of a good thing to accomplish, I think. So even if it doesn't decrease hospitalizations, increasing quality of life is important. But once again, it's a difficult thing to do. And, you know, natural aging venues like seniors' apartment buildings, which are not necessarily subsidized by anybody, but it would take only in those kind of things, would take only a small amount of money to organize social events and stuff that would be sort of like mixers, like you do in dormitories for when people start university.
Yeah, I had the experience in my own family. After my late mother died, my father really became a hermit, as you mentioned, Barry, because she was the social force in the duet there. And he clearly started deteriorating. And there was nobody who could visit the situation. And even though it was with great reluctance, he agreed to move to be Chicago, where my sister lives, and reluctantly agreed to move into a retirement home. And in addition to having medication adjusted for things that he was self-medicating, which were terrible, he was almost reborn with the social integration. And it was amazing when I'd go to visit him, he would introduce me to all his new buddies. And I realized they all knew about me because he must have been talking about me because they would call me by my name. And it was really something because he was very resistant. You know, he kept saying, "I'm fine," which you often hear. But the latent need for interaction was clearly there, and he really blossomed. And I think we all see situations like that. Sometimes the only option is to move into congregate living of one form or another, or day programs in one form or another. And many of us do have them. And there are, as you mentioned, Sprint and other very good quality day programs. And if you can get transportation, which is often key, you really can provide that social stimulation, which I think is really important because we all know we are social beings. Now, during COVID, we really observed the vulnerabilities within long-term care facilities. Now, do you think we've learned enough to take measures that should there be, which there likely will at some point or another similar type of outbreak to make sure what we saw in COVID-19, separate from immunization and all that other stuff, to decrease the risk that we have such a bad outcome as we did?
I don't know. I'm sometimes a little bit pessimistic. Remember the Geriatric and Long-Term Care Review Committee?
Mm.
One of the impetuses for starting it was the influenza outbreak at a nursing home in Northern Toronto. That should have been a wake-up call to make sure we were prepared for even more deadly pandemics, but we weren't. And we did learn about cooperating with public health with influenza epidemics, at least letting people who knew something know, but we didn't progress that much beyond it. And so we were not prepared for COVID, even though we had experience with other infections that should have prepared us better. So I don't know. I'm hoping so. But, you know, it seems like institutional memory is not as good as it should be.
Yeah.
You know, like in SARS-1, when we stockpiled all the personal protective equipment and then let it rot in warehouses rather than selling it to the hospitals in a rotating basis so that we'd always have fresh supplies, like, that's stupid. Yeah. Like, that's the only way I can describe it. And so we were totally unprepared, whereas we'd had stockpiles that we let rot.
Yeah, it is interesting how you keep saying, you know, we always say, you know, if you don't remember your history, you're doomed to repeat it. It seems that in public health, we keep repeating it and repeating it because it's not new. I know that some of the retirement homes that I'm involved with seem to be much more sensitive to any minor outbreak in terms of keeping it from spreading and taking on measures to try to contain it for short periods. But, you know, the whole issue of staffing and people going from one facility to another, we can't solve that until it becomes clear how you keep somebody financially in one place when many of them have to go from one place to another, just because the financial structure is that way. Now, for the final question, this is a, you might say, acknowledgement of the wonderful work done, especially through the University of Toronto. But it's notable that in the last, I don't know who does the rating, that the University Health Network, Toronto General Hospital, achieved the remarkable feat of being ranked third in the world publicly funded hospitals. And of course, you're very involved with that institution. In fact, all of us in Toronto are involved with it one way or the other, because I've had many patients of mine treated there in my early days of being in Toronto. I actually worked there. I did training in nuclear medicine in the one of the first departments of nuclear medicine, which was at TGH. So what, in your opinion, of the specific practices or approaches employed by institutions such as TGH contribute to their success in delivering exceptional care? And how can other healthcare organizations learn for achievements? If you look at the list, a number of them are from the United States, but a number of them are European. And sometimes I know there's a tendency in the United States, being American, I'm very aware of a lot of things in America, to forget that there's a lot of good understanding and knowledge around the world, and we have to sometimes look abroad to look at best practices. So what do you think TGH has as their secret recipe, as KFC would say?
I'm always skeptical. You know, I was taught when I was, it might have been from you even, Michael, I don't remember. It should be noted that first inspiration for people to go into geriatric medicine in Canada came from Michael Gordon, because he was such a fabulous physician and such a great individual as well. So when you read an article, you're supposed to read, forget about the introduction, read the methods and the results, not the discussion, and make up your mind there before you read the rest. So the question is always, what were the methods for determining what's an excellent hospital? Toronto General, let me say right, excellent hospital. I'm very impressed by it. But the way to get on the top ranking is to do what is considered sexy. Yes. So Toronto General is one of the top transplant hospitals in the world. That gives you marks. And we've known, for example, you know, when they used to do a lot more experts picking the top doctors in the world, we knew of doctors who hadn't seen a patient in several years, but had done groundbreaking research, named as a top doctor, yes, top doctors. You wouldn't want them to treat you. You know, when I started at Toronto Western, the chief of surgery was a cardiac surgeon, because there was cardiac surgery there before it all migrated to Toronto General, who was so involved in administration in the Department of Surgery and with the Royal College that he really didn't do enough surgery. And he was picked as one of the outstanding cardiac surgeons. But in fact, it was the chief residents doing the surgery, right, and he would be supervising to make sure that everything was going well. But he didn't trust himself to do it. Yet he was voted as one of the top. So you have to be skeptical about these things and figure out the methodology of how it's done. And it's clearly for the hospitals. They're all heavily research-intensive hospitals, and their research is in usually things like cardiology, intensive care, and transplantation, because those are the things that make for headlines in newspapers and stuff. You know, there are, for simple things, like in Toronto, in orthopedic surgery with the anterior approach for hip replacement, that was community hospitals that pioneered it, not the teaching hospitals. So that allows for day surgery for a hip replacement. And so that was innovative stuff done in a community hospital, some of whom for standard things, if not better care, provide more efficient care than the teaching hospitals. Once you have layers of residents and students, efficiency takes a bit of a hit, not necessarily quality, but efficiency can be difficult. But Toronto General is a great hospital, but if you want to be on the top 10 list, you have to do what's sexy for the newspapers and for reviewers and stuff.
I agree. And you know, the old dictum is you got to know what the metric is before you say it's high, because sometimes it's the wrong metric. And obviously research is one of the metrics, and clinical care may not be a metric, and it's much harder teaching to evaluate. I've been ill over the years, and I've had treatment in a good many of the Toronto hospitals, teaching and otherwise. And I'm very, very pleased to say I've always had good care in every one of them. And I tell my patients, they say, well, where's the best place to go? And I say, I can't tell you what the best place, but part of it is what's the convenient place, because you want to be able to get there easily. And when I was really ill, my care was actually at St. Michael's Hospital, which is one of the teaching hospitals. And if you would look at it, it would be the equivalent of an American inner city hospital. And American inner city hospitals are actually some of the best hospitals in America, but they don't make any list because they're not the ones that do the research necessarily, but the ones that, if you want your training, you're really on the front lines. And I trained at one of them in the States. And, you know, it's an interesting thing, but you can live with acknowledgement that you're at one of the great hospitals, but I know you're also at one of the other great hospitals, Mount Sinai. And most of all, you and I are at one of the great universities, which is University of Toronto. But I want to thank you on behalf of Health Plexus and Journal of Clinical Care. And for the, how many years do we know each other? 45?
We met for the first time in July of 1974.
Wow. Oh, wow. Yeah.
So we're hitting 50 years.
Yeah, that was the year after I arrived in Canada. Well, and look how well we've aged. We each still have some hair. Anyway, it's been a pleasure always to work with you, discuss things with you, meet you at these wonderful get-togethers through Division of Geriatrics. And thank you very much for participating in this podcast.
A pleasure. And always great seeing you and speaking to you.
Bye.
Goodbye.